Welcome, everyone, to the Out of Chicago podcast. Today, I'm here with landscape photographer extraordinaire, Aaron Bobnick. Welcome to the show, Aaron.
Hey, Chris. Thanks so much. Great to be here again.
Of course. Yes, I forgot. Yeah, I mean, I didn't forget, but I forgot to say it, that this is not the first time you've been on the show. So welcome back. Today, we are going to do a little bit of Aaron Bobnick Q&A. We are going to ask tons of questions. She actually put it out on her Facebook to a bunch of her followers asking for questions. So if some of these questions sound like not your typical question you might ask, that's not my fault. That's their fault. So we're going to run through a whole bunch of different things, but we're going to start out with a really big one and a really tough one, and one that doesn't have probably an easy answer. And that is that, I mean, you heard me say it's Aaron Bobnick. She's a great landscape photographer. But one thing that makes Aaron different than probably 90% of the landscape photographers out there is that she's a female. That she, it's not easy being a female in the landscape photography business. So can you talk a little bit about that and some of the difficulties and how you may do things different than other people or just choose not to? I don't know.
Yeah, well, I can say quite a lot about that. I'm not sure that the difficulties are easy to put a finger on, but I will say that I think what most women face, and I can say this because I actually founded a group for women landscape photographers about, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago, and there are 400 women in the group. And so just hearing stories from them and the things that most people do find challenging, I can say that in a lot of regards, I'm kind of the exception that proves the rule. So I haven't necessarily experienced all of those challenges myself, but the sorts of things that people seem to kind of come up against are the fact that because there are so many men in landscape photography who tend to dominate the professional end of things, and also who maybe just are more numerous, period. I don't know. It's harder for women to find mentors. So mentorship is the one thing that keeps coming up again and again, again and again in the group. So, you know, a bunch of guys, they want to go out shooting, they call up a buddy and the buddy comes along. They're less likely to call up some woman, you know, unless they happen to be buddies. And, you know, that's where I kind of, I think got lucky early on, is that I just happened to have all these buddies. And, and right, that was definitely how I learned a lot, was just by hanging out with friends. I grew up with brothers. My father actually raised me through most of my childhood. So I'm really comfortable around guys. And I had no problem just sort of fitting into that mix. Whereas for a lot of women, it's either uncomfortable or else even unacceptable for them to do it. Or it may be unacceptable in the minds of the guys to be with the women, you know? So that's a tricky area right there, I think, just getting started for women.
Now, how about as far as going out and shooting on your own? Or did you kind of answer that? Like, would you be comfortable? I mean, that's the thing. It's like, oh, it's 5, 6 o'clock. The sun's going down. It's time to go get those great shots, but I've got to go hike out on the trail all by myself with all this expensive gear. I may have to go out quite a ways. And when I come back, it's going to be totally dark. And a lot of people, a lot of women, a lot of men too, would be worried to go out on their own and do that. Do you just say, forget it? Or do you make sure that you've got a group that you're going with? And that's kind of what you're talking about here.
Yeah, actually, you know, the one place where I feel the safest is out in the wilderness. And I have no problems at all going out there by myself, because out there, my biggest fear is of, the predators of the two-legged variety. And you don't find too many of those out there. So when I used to shoot cityscapes, that was my first love. I used to go out and shoot a lot. I loved the blue hour, and I would do all kinds of cityscape stuff with lights, and I would even bring strobes out.
We need to have you come to Chicago then.
So that was, I was all about that, and just like going out and lighting up ruins and that kind of thing, or old, you know, World War I bunkers and stuff like that. And I would gel my lights, and I had a great time with that. But I was terrified of doing that, and especially when I was alone, because I felt like I was in an urban environment with lots of really expensive gear, and I felt very vulnerable. Yeah, and I do not have that feeling when I'm just out in the wilderness doing nature photography.
So for someone that may be worried about that, it's kind of, you know, you're going to feel, you know, it's not going to be as bad as you think, or find a group of people to go with. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, if you're in an area where you're at all, you feel like, you know, that it's just too risky. Well, yeah, find a buddy, but see, they're back to point one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can be a little difficult for us.
Yeah. But it might be something, you know, to go to your local camera club or whatever it may be and just say, hey, do Absolutely. You mind if I join you guys, or get a group of women together, you know, strength in numbers, right?
Yeah. Exactly. So yeah, that's been a big part of my group, is to get women sort of talking to each other and mentoring each other.
And what's the name of your group? Is this something people can join?
SheScapes.
SheScapes. I love it. And it's on Facebook?
Yeah, that's on Facebook.
Okay. And you'll let people in?
If they're women.
Yeah, I was going to say, not me apparently, but all right, fine. I can handle that. All right. So you lead a ton of workshops all over the world, really, but you've got a few favorite places that you go. Tell us, first off, what are some of the places you take people to? And then I want to learn a little bit more about what people can learn when they go on their workshops.
Sure. Well, my two go-to areas where I spend the most time have been the Dolomites and Death Valley, probably. But lately, I've been branching out and doing a lot of workshops in the French Alps. Have recently branched out into the highlands of Iceland. And then I do a lot of other locations more sporadically. And I've done quite a bit in on the Oregon coast. And then out of Chicago has brought me to places that I hadn't been before, such as Acadia. So, you know, those sorts of things pop up as well.
That's right. I mean, that should have been part of the intro also, is that I think maybe you're the only person possibly that's done all of our out of landscape conferences. So out of Acadia. Oh no, Nick Page maybe is the other one too. So out of Acadia, out of Moab, and this year you'll be teaching at the Out of Oregon event as well. So we're super excited for that. But, you know, as far as going on these workshops or teaching at one of our events, you know, what are some things that, you know, there's so many things out there as far as videos and blogs and all of that, and you do a great job. Erin, you're a great writer, you're a great speaker, and all of that. But what are some things that, you know, people can really only learn when they're in person, in the field, or even in a critique session or whatever it may be, but that you can only get with that in-person experience?
Feedback, immediate feedback, and also guidance, creative coaching on a more personal level. So the sorts of things that you can do when you're not with an instructor and at home is you can work on technique quite well. You know, you can just kind of take in a whole bunch of wonderful education that way. You can learn something about processing. You can learn a lot about how to work a camera, you know, everything. But what you get from one-on-one interaction with an instructor and with your fellow participants is a whole other level of learning that is far more conducive to developing your own sensibilities, to getting instant feedback on decisions that you're making, especially of the creative variety.
Yeah, this is kind of off topic here, sorry. But I've never thought of this before, but I taught high school for 18 years, and it was like, you know, I taught physics. And so the kids would go home and they would struggle with their homework for 3 hours, and they'd come in the next morning to get a little bit of extra help, and I'd have them straightened out in like 1 minute. And they're like, oh, that was all I had to do. And it's really a similar thing here too. You can watch a video, you can struggle in the field, but if you're right there next to the expert, they'll be like, oh, wait, all you had to do is this. And they're like, oh, that was it. And that just fixes it right there. And so you can get so much more out of that in-person experience when you're doing that.
Yeah, that's a good point. It actually can just accelerate everything. So you can bang your head against a wall for a long time and then have a real aha moment when someone just sort of shines a little light on something for you.
Right. So maybe you kind of hit this, but like, what are some of the best things that people should work on if they want to brush up on their skills or whatever before they get to your workshop? Because I'm sure you sometimes, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but maybe get a little frustrated, like, well, you should have had that figured out before you even got here or whatever. Like, what are things people should be working on that are good to work on at home?
Well, I have a workshop reading list on my website, and I encourage people to go through all of that because it's a lot of the stuff that I think is kind of foundational and helpful. And if they have gone through all of that, we can take it much further in person. So there's that, and it's about, I don't know, a couple dozen articles and videos on there. but there are, you know, there are a lot of things that people can do. And I don't have prerequisites for my workshops, except for one. I have the masterclass series, and I'm going to bring that back at the end of this year, just going to do one more session of it. But for that one, I require that anyone who signs up must have full command of their camera. So that's, you know, which is actually asking a lot so that we can move on and work on higher level things to do with creativity and composition and that sort of thing. But for most of the workshops, you know, it's okay if they haven't done anything and they just kind of want to jump in baptism by fire, that works too.
Right, right. Well, that's the key to being a master teacher, is kind of taking anybody from where they are, no matter how high or how low, and taking them to the next level.
Yeah. Agreed.
Yeah. And then someone on your Facebook wanted to know, like, when you're doing your workshops, do you give out your post-processing secrets? Because really what Erin, you know, a big part of what she's known for, and she's got dramatic landscapes, but it's, and you can make the percentages yourself, but it's like half that it's a great image and half maybe, I don't know, of post-processing as well. So do you give your post-processing tips away in your workshops? And maybe tell us a little bit about what you do in your workshops, because you were explaining that to me before we started recording, and it was pretty interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. I hold nothing back in my workshops. I have in most of them, a full day at least of post-processing instruction as a seminar in a conference room. None of this look over my shoulder at a laptop business. No, it's like for real, you know, big screen, everybody can see it. Everybody's comfortable in a conference room. Usually hand out dishes of candy to keep them all awake, you know, and we just go for it. And I show people, I take it in sort of a module fashion so that nobody gets left behind and everybody can get this kind of cross section of all the things that I think can be really useful to a landscape photographer. So we do that, but yeah, just to answer your question about all of the workshops, what I do. So in addition to the processing seminars, I also have seminars on composition, on creativity. I do one on the history of landscape photography. I do one on, personal, creativity, where I have people bring in some of their own work and we talk about their work, and I look to sort of draw a line through what it looks like they seem to be doing. Cause a lot of times people can't see that in their own work. Like, have you noticed that, you know, in your portfolio, you seem to really be working on this or have an interest in this, and you might want to do some more along those lines and that sort of thing. That's really helpful to them. So yeah, there's just a lot that you can do as you know, in the conferences that you run, that isn't necessarily, you know, field work, that can really bolster it and accelerate the learning process.
Right. And that's kind of what you're saying, is that what you're doing is actually very similar to what we do in our conferences, where you're in the field, but you're also in the classroom. There's critique time and just time to hang out and be able to ask those questions that you've always wanted to ask. Right. I mean, that's part of that in-person part too, is just the social aspect almost, but, you know, to ask more informal type questions.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the critique time. I call it image review, because it's not, I don't like to think of it as I'm just picking apart people's images. In fact, I tell people, don't bring me your favorite image. Bring me the one that you're not sure about, the one that, how can I be helpful? Bring me in the image reviews, not the portfolio reviews. And that sets it up differently. What do you really want feedback on? The photo where you just wish you could just ask somebody something. I know that I get that sometimes, you know, and when my friends are all asleep or whatever, I have no one to turn to, you know.
And I'm here sure for you. People... Oh, thanks, Chris. I wouldn't be able to help you, but So, you know, actually that reminds me of a question that I was thinking about asking you, and it wasn't in our list. So are you ready for one
Go
off
for
the cuff?
It. What you got?
All right. So when you do these, I love it, image reviews as opposed to critiques. I love it. When you do the image reviews, what's the one thing that you keep kind of coming back to? It seems like you're always telling people, you know, is there one or two things where it's like, everyone seems to kind of need to work on this one thing a little bit. And do you see a theme there, or is every single person a totally different thing?
I mean, there are things that tend to come up a lot, and it tend to be compositional issues. That's the trickiest area for a lot of people, but other people are more advanced with their composition, and they they have not yet developed the eye for seeing things and processing that is working against their compositions and that sort of thing. So in either case, it kind of comes back to composition, I think, because in my view, processing is working in the service of a composition. So those two areas, a lot of times people, if they have let's say a grand landscape that's sort of working on a clear sense of visual hierarchy, it might be something where that hierarchy is not at all clear because of the way they processed it. Your eyes just getting pulled all over the place. Whereas the photo's fine. It just, just needs to be a little bit more under control with the processing so that you have a greater sense of flow and hierarchy in the image. So that kind of thing is really common.
So let's talk a little bit about, you've got some very interesting ideas for, I think, how you shoot and for how you process in terms of this conceptual idea. And I also think that it goes along with this article, I could be wrong, that you wrote for Photocascadia. Actually, it was like 4 or 5 years ago, and you've updated it. It was originally, what, 5 patterns to look for in nature?
Yeah.
And then you did 4 more, which were really, really cool, ones I hadn't even thought of. And then to see how they apply to your images was crazy. Now, are those similar concepts when you're saying you want to look at the landscape conceptually, or are those different things?
Totally related, yeah. So even in the first 5, they're all, the thing that, why that article is so popular and why I revisited it, was not only because it's the 10th anniversary of Photocascadia and we're doing a little retrospective series, but I chose that one in particular because it was wildly popular, translated into a bunch of languages, and it's the one that people most reference when we're talking about composition. And it cut the cake a different way and helped people run with something compositionally that they didn't have before they read the article, you know?
Right. And it gives something very concrete to work toward as opposed to rule of thirds or, you know, put
yes.
something in foreground, middle yeah. ground, background. Like, can we run through what these 5 are? I have them in front of me from the first
sure.
one.
Sure.
Yeah. Just so people have an idea. I love it. Well, like, and you've
do
got
you want me to just sort of characterize the 2 sets or?
Sure. Yeah.
Oh yeah. So the first set of 5 addressed the standard kind of conventional kind of landscape image that has a front to back visual flow and a clear sense of visual hierarchy, your basic grand landscape kind of a thing. The second set addresses those that are just the opposite for the most part, although there's some overlap between the sets, but those that tend to work best for the so-called small scenes and the abstracts. But in either case, they're working on this idea of, I called them patterns, but they're basically concepts. They're ideas, they're compositional ideas that give you something to work towards rather than going out and looking for things that are strictly visual. It's an idea that you can build off of. For example, in the first 5, I had the echo. So the echo composition is where something in the frame seems to echo the other one formally or in some way. Those two seem to be in dialogue because they look alike, but they're not the two of exactly the same thing. One echoes the other. In the new set, likewise are all sort of conceptual, such as the binary. So that's where you have a couple of things in the frame where one is sort of setting the other off. So it's sort of the thing and the foil to the thing, or two things that and what makes the binary kind of work is that you've found these things in the same place in nature, you know, that this is both going on at the same time. And that's fun. It's like, you know, the viewer sees that and like, wow, that there's a certain irony there. That's really cool that those two things are right next to each other. You know? So, and if you're working off of ideas like that, rather than I'm looking for a leading line and it's going to go to something that's on the rule of that's on the third, you know, like it's a whole yeah. different way in, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So like this binary, the example that you give are these reeds in the water. And is the binary the fact that you've got this golden light on the reeds, but then you've got this cool blue vertical slits as well, and they just play off of each other, right?
Yeah. And plus, because the dappled light's playing across those reeds, you also have lit and unlit. So that one has binaries where you also have water versus the foliage. So you have a few different binaries there that are interesting. The first one, the wallpaper, is probably the easiest to understand and just to conceive of. It's also probably one of the hardest to find in nature. And I like pointing this out because although it seems so simple, the wallpaper, it's just an even pattern all over the frame, right? And so at first your eye sees sameness and that's kind of like, oh, okay, it's all the same thing. Oh, but wait, oh, that mud tile turns up that way, and that one's pockmarked by rain, and that one's got a little crack in it, and no two are actually the same. And so it becomes this delightful game for the eye to go and find all those little variations. So although that seems wonderfully simple, it's actually very, very difficult to find these in nature. And so that's why it's so exciting for people to see that kind of regularity is actually hard to find, like something with a lot of grand landscapes, when you can set up any kind of like symmetry or something like that. That's why symmetry is kind of fun to see in a landscape image, because it actually doesn't exist that often in nature. It's hard to find.
Right. It's not like architecture.
Right.
Yeah.
Precisely. And that's why in my composition talk, I make a big point about how compositional ideas are kind of relevant to certain genres. You know, they don't necessarily work exactly the same way across the board.
Yeah, I think there's a whole other idea there when you're talking about the simplicity. To me, that's the most difficult thing about landscape photography. It's easy to make a crazy complex, things are all over the place, but to take nature and to distill it down to something very simple that you can digest easily is a difficult thing. Simple is not easy.
That's really well put, yeah.
And I love, I didn't even notice the difference between the first five and the next four. Like these first five, it's the plunge, the echo, the layer cake, the arrow, and the hub. I love the names. But they're all kind of about leading you into the image more, like from front to back, it seems.
Right.
Like you said. And the other ones are more, maybe not always, but a little more two-dimensional, that they're spread out over like one plane rather than this real 3D front to back.
More so.
Oh man. And those not, are,
that's a requirement, but yeah, in general, it's a tendency.
Yeah. The wallpaper, the mandala. Is that how you say it?
I think mandala is the American pronunciation.
Oh, well then, yeah, then correct me for sure. The binary and the simile. So very cool. And in my head, I've thought, you know, I keep seeing my images where they always kind of have the same flow, the same kind of like shape to them. And I've always thought I want to put it together into something. And you've just done it so perfectly here that I don't have to now.
Well, thank you.
No, I love it. So in the past, you've done a talk on composition. I think that was the one in Acadia. Do you remember? And then she's going back to her notes. And then
what have I been talking about?
In Moab, did you do color theory, or is that the one you're thinking about for Oregon?
No, I was thinking about that for Oregon. Yeah, in Moab, I actually did one that I'll be doing again in Los Angeles for Canon next month. So anyone who's in the LA area on May 21st, come see me in Costa Mesa. That is the 7 Virtues of a Creative Landscape Photographer.
Right.
So that's why I did Moab. I actually think it's one of my most important talks. It really enables me to talk about pretty much everything that I think is super important in landscape photography. But the color theory is near and dear to me, and that's one of my most requested topics. People really want more of that from me ever since my by far most popular article I've ever put out was the color theory one. I'll incorporate that into something in the Oregon conference. I don't know if it'll be the big talk or what, but it'll be there.
good. Yeah. I know a lot of people have been asking for that. So, as far as the Oregon event, it's been sold out for a really, really long time. People can still get on the wait list, and I'd still say there's still a pretty good chance that you may be able to get on, you know, from the wait list. But go to outofchicago.com and look for Oregon, and it's got directions for how to get on the wait list. But you said that basically all of your workshops this year are sold out as well, right?
At the moment they are, yeah. I'm going to add one more in early December. My masterclass is coming back for Death Valley. I had so many people emailing me asking if I was ever going to do that again. So I'm going to do it.
you got to give the people what they want, right?
That's right. Yeah,
that's good.
But then it's on to 2020. And I'll be listing all of those, I hope, at the end of this month. All the 2020 stuff will go up.
So all of her workshops, for the most part here, are all sold out. If you wanted to join, you couldn't. So you want to make sure that you know right away when her new workshops are coming out. And so the best way to do that is to go to Erin's site, which is erinbobnick.com. And Bobnick, we got to do your first and last name. So E-R-I-N-B-A-B-N-I-K. Did I get that right?
Right. You got that right. No, so, C.
You'll see. That's right. So Aaron, and it's not, and this doesn't matter for typing in the web address, but it's not Babnick or anything like that. It's Aaron Bobnick.
Well, I'll respond to that too.
yeah. But we like getting it right. So if you go to her site, you can sign up for her newsletter, and that's where you would be the first to know when these workshops for next year are available and when you've got new articles and when you're doing new podcasts and everything else, right?
That's right. That's the place to go. The newsletter is where it all comes together.
But I make it sound like we're like wrapping this up, but I'm going to keep asking questions for a really long time.
All right. Awesome.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Keep going. Yeah.
you know, I also wanted to mention, since all these things are sold out, there's one other thing that you're going to be a part of this year, and that is the Sedona Photo Symposium. Do you want to talk for just a second about that?
Yeah, that's a really interesting idea. Obviously, I'm a big supporter of the idea because it's not unlike what Out of Chicago is doing. I think it's similar in a lot of ways in that there are some outdoor excursions and indoor programs. And I believe there are still tickets available for that. I personally will be doing both of those things. I'll be doing a big talk, an outdoor, several outdoor classes, and I think one breakout session also on composition there. And then there's also going to be a roundtable discussion with, I think, me and Guy Tall and Rick Salmon and I think maybe one other person.
Oh, some of my favorites. Yeah. And I know that I believe Colleen Minnick-Sperry will be there.
Yes, well. Yes, right? She's there too. Yeah. I'm not sure if she's on that final panel, but I think she might be. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, either way. Yeah. Love her. Love you. Love Guy Tall.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Agreed.
Sorry.
So, and likewise.
Oh, thanks, Aaron. So that's the Sedona Photo Symposium. I think it's from some people that always maybe were attendees or helped out with the Moab Photo Symposium, which last year was the last year for that. And so they're picking it back up, but in Sedona. And I think there are still some spots available if people are interested.
Yeah, I think so.
Fantastic. So you mentioned that you are doing a talk for Canon coming up at the end of May. You've been doing a lot of things for Canon. You're a big Canon shooter.
Supportive. Yeah.
Tell us about the tell us about some of the gear that you use and how you've been working with Canon.
Well, some of the most exciting gear that I used recently. They called me up and asked if I'd be willing to show the world what some pre-production gear could do, some stuff that hadn't been released yet.
And secret things?
Yeah.
Tell us what the secret things are.
Well, the secret things are out now. They're not secrets anymore. So I got to play with, it was an EOS R and this new drop-in filter mount adapter. So this is super exciting because what it enables you to do is use any and all EF lenses, anything, including the big old Canon 11-24mm, the 100-400, all these lenses that could be completely different in focal length and filter size and everything.
17 tilt shift?
Yes, right? Any of these really awesome lenses with a single filter, you know? one polarizer will cover them all. And they have a variable ND also. So I think it's 6 stops of filtration at the max there. So you're pretty well covered there with 2 little drop-in filters. You're kind of done. And it was just so much fun.
You're talking about an adapter that so that you can put the old regular EF lenses on the new mirrorless camera. But the adapter itself, the little bit that goes between the old lens and the brand new camera, is where you put that filter. Is that
It drops right in there, and it's all weather sealed and it's stuck to the body. So all you have to do is change lenses, and that thing sits behind the lens connected to the body, and it has this little thumb wheel. So it's just like working the controls on your camera. It had this wonderful fluid sense of just being, you know, one with the camera. And I found it very, very fun to work with. So they wanted me to produce a series of photos. I had about 3 days with that stuff, and it went so well that they actually made that a feature on the front page of Canon USA for a full month. So that stuff's all out now. You can see what my thoughts about it in that article that I wrote for them. And now you can actually pick that stuff up. That's shipping.
So did you want to give us your quick thoughts? You decided you don't like it at all? It's not good?
I abs- absolutely love it. No, I just, it was very, very exciting for me. I haven't been that kind of, I'm not a huge gearhead, you know, but that kind of just really sparked my something in me. It was just so much fun. It was a whole different way of working with filters. Polarizers can be just so wonderful for landscape photography, and same with variable NDs, especially if you're working around water. And so it just made everything so much easier and so much fun. And especially with these lenses where, you know, a long lens, you know, you're fiddling with stuff way out on the end of it usually, and you're usually dropping stuff, or you don't have the right size filter, or and for the 11 to 24, they're these like satellite dish size contraptions.
Right. It's the same thing. Yeah. Like when I shot the, like I mentioned, the 17 millimeter tilt shift, like you can't even put filters on it without this crazy thing out in front of it. Yeah.
Exactly. So. Yeah. So it was just like, are you kidding me? This is amazing. And it adds almost no weight or bulk to everything. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Just loved it.
And what are your general impressions of the new mirrorless cameras?
Well, I haven't played with the RP. I've only played with the R, and I also, they gave me an M50 that I've had for a while now, and I love that camera too, but it's more like my sort of go-to, always with me, just whatever camera. But the R, there were a lot of nice features there that I was very happy to have. The swivel screen, of course, focus peaking. It has this wonderful, very innovative idea where when you take the lens off, automatically little doors snap shut and cover the sensor so no dust can get in there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool. I don't think any other mirrorless cameras have that feature.
No, so
it's just all this kind of smart stuff that, you know, plus the drop-in filter mount adapter was just, that was it for me.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those things. It's like, it's canon. Like, you knew that when it came out and this stuff came out that it was going to be awesome, and they were going to have it. It was, everything was going to be done right. So it
sounds like... Exactly. That's the thing. They were slow to get things out sometimes, but that's because they're going to make sure it's right.
Yeah, but now it's here and it's exciting. Oh, I see a question here that I didn't actually finish, so I'm going to try and make it up as I go. So I sent you half of a question. Are you ready for it?
Sure.
Like some of these things come into my head and I'm like, this is like what I'm wondering, but I just don't know how to ask it. So that's why I guess I didn't finish it. Like when you're out, what, as far as your photography, what is the most important thing to you? Is it all about being in nature? Is it more that it's all about some sort of a creative process that you're going through? You just love to be creative, even if it wasn't in nature? Oh man, I see I'm making her nervous. I got her on the video, even though you guys are only seeing the audio.
My little gears are turning because those are actually really good questions.
And then the third one that I didn't finish is like, maybe it's just about the adventure. Like maybe you just want to get out and have some sort of an adventure. Like, would it be more important to you to be out in nature even if you didn't have a camera? Or is it more important that you have a camera, you're being creative, even if it wasn't out in nature?
That would be a tough one for me because,
or is it just a combination? Yeah,
it really is. It's just the fact that I can put those two things together, the two strains of my life together, is what makes photography the winning thing in my life. And that's why it's pretty much, it just shoots through everything I do. Photography is my life. But I was also into other types of photography before I was into landscape photography. You know, I did everything and I enjoyed that too. So it's hard to say, I don't think they're that separable, but I definitely enjoy going for long hikes and backpacking and everything. And sometimes I never take the camera out. It'll be there with me, but I don't, you know, I'm just enjoying the experience and the adventure. And then there are other times when, you know, I'm just sitting at home and I really enjoy the processing and I'm not out at all and I'm having a great time there too. and I used to enjoy doing photography that wasn't landscape at all. And that was a creative process. You know, I used to have this really fun setup for doing product photography, you know, with the light box and everything. And, you know, I really enjoyed figuring out how do you make this handbag look awesome? You know, I really got into that too. So.
No, yeah, that's good.
I like that I don't have to choose.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Good point. It's the combination of the two. But were you into like mountains and climbing, hiking before you were into photography? Or was it like, now that I'm super into photography, I should go find something to climb?
Yeah, no, I was always very outdoorsy and very into backpacking. And I would just carry around, I used to have this little panoramic film camera that I took around, but it was just for snapshots. I did not know what I was doing with it. And it wasn't until my art history background, you know, got me into photography again, and I got kind of annoyed with all of the requirements of photographing at archaeological sites. But I loved outdoor photography, and I was like, you know that thing I used to do with the backpacks and the mountains? Let's do that again. That would be, I could still do this photography stuff and I don't have to deal with all of these rules and regulations and of like when I have access to go photograph the temple or whatever, you know?
Right. Yeah. But that fits in with like some of the great, you know, landscape photographers of all time, that they were really into the nature and climbing and whatever before they were photographers. But it's because of that love of the subject that they became such great photographers, whether it's Art Wolf or Galen Rowell or whoever it may be, that, you know, they were already climbing mountains, and then you're like, yeah, hey, bring my stuff with.
My story is a little different in that it wasn't the outdoor stuff that got me into the photography. It was sort of these two strands of my life that I'd never thought to put together. I've always been into art in some way, shape, or form, and I've always been outdoorsy. And it's kind of funny that it took me so long to be like, hey, these two things can go together.
Yeah, no, and that makes sense. Yeah, and you have that art and art history background, and we talked about that a lot more last time. You were on the podcast, and I'll link to that as well. But someone wanted to know on your Facebook, do you recommend other books on color theory? Are there other books out there, maybe not even related to photography, but just the art part of it, that you would recommend for people to read?
Yeah, that's a good question. And all I can say is that color theory, composition, and the history of landscape photography are all areas where, as far as I know, especially the history of landscape photography, there is no one reference book that I've got on my shelf that I can say that's my go-to. In fact, nobody's written the history of landscape photography. I've been writing it. Somebody needs to, please, someone write that book.
You do it.
People said that to me before, but so I've got this whole seminar that I've been doing on. I've been researching it and putting it together, and that's a lot of fun, but I don't have a resource for that. Same thing with everything that I wrote in my color theory article. That's not coming out of a book. That's just years and years of being an art educator and just what I've kind of gravitated into, and things I've picked up here and there is just a lot of received wisdom, and then a lot of just picking and choosing what works for me, and then I put that together. Composition, you know, there are some really excellent books on composition, but none of them take the tack that I do with my articles. That's a different way in, you know, this a sort of idea-based approach to looking for composition. So I'm afraid I can't be very helpful in the book end of things with that.
Well, no, it sounds like you've distilled it all in these places that, you know, we'll put links to these articles on Photocascadia. Where do we find the article on color theory that you did?
That's also on Photocascadia. It was resyndicated in Petapixel as well, but the main article lives on Photocascadia.
All right. Fabulous. So here's a really tough question. These are from your people, though, not me.
I know. So,
except the second part is for me. The first part is social media killing creativity? And then my part to that is, what do you do about that as a photographer?
Yeah, I actually would say that social media, and I can see why people would say that, it's not social media per se, it's people's reliance upon it. Social media tends to put forward certain types of images that do well on social media. And so that it perpetuates this, you know, that it's a big echo chamber in a lot of ways. But there is also a lot of creativity there. And it also is not the end all be all of what there is in the world as input for a creative person. If you want to look at great photography, you can look at books, you can look at magazines, you can look at people's websites, I think is really where a lot of people should go. Just bookmark people's websites. You know, I do not post hardly at all on social media, but I put a lot more stuff on my website. And in my articles and in my talks and in my seminars, you'll see a lot more of my photos there than you'll ever see on Instagram. And also, you know, go to museums, look at other types of art. It doesn't all have to be photography. So I think that it's not that social media there's anything necessarily wrong with it. It's just that I think a lot of people don't realize that there's more to life than that. They can be very inspired and very creative just by taking that as just sort of one slice of their kind of stream of input.
So do you ever get to the point where you're like, man, you know, I know thousands of people have shot from the same spot, and I don't, how am I going to do something that's different than everybody else? And how do you work against that? You know, everyone should got the same thing. What do you do?
Yeah. You know, for one thing, I like to go places where I can hear myself think and I don't feel haunted by a million other photographers who've been there before. So I put out a whole series on exploration because I believe that that's how I form my own sensibilities as an artist. And I believe that you can do that kind of exploration, that kind of creative exploration, without ever even leaving your home. In my talk for B&H, I started out by saying my first foray into photographic exploration was while I was writing my dissertation. I was just sticking a telephoto lens out a window because I felt trapped. And I was in this tall building, and I could photograph all kinds of things. I have this amazing variety of images that I was shooting just out that window, exploring with the telephoto lens. And so I like to go places where I have that option, you know, where it's big, I just get out there and I can work things out for myself and I don't have to think about what other people have done necessarily in exactly that spot. That said, sometimes when you go to a spot and it is a place where a lot of people have produced photographs, it's interesting that people can have a different response to a place, and there are different ideas to be had. They may not be the sort of classical grand landscape sort. They might be something on a much smaller scale. And then sometimes it just comes down to having a different approach to the processing that can, I mean, as simple as that, that can really produce make something look new again.
Yeah, no. And I think you're just a master at that. And well, I know you said to me before we started recording that like you don't do a ton of processing. You're not overhanded. And I agree with that, but there's something so special about the way that you process your images that given to someone else, it would be like, I don't know. It's okay.
Let me qualify that. I do a ton of processing. Okay, I actually do. Okay. I just don't do really emphatic pushed colors and punchy processing.
Right? I gotcha.
It's actually harder to do what I do than to do the punchy processing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm really good at doing the saturation slider, even just exactly. That all alone. Yeah, I'm awesome at that.
It's not just pushing sliders around. It's being very, very selective and working nuances in or out of the image.
Yeah, I think one of the most interesting things I heard, I mentioned this, is when you were on the F-Stop Collaborate and Listen podcast with those guys, or was it with the Photog Adventures? Maybe it was with the Photog Adventures one, because you've done so many podcasts. I think it was that one. So you've been with the Photog Adventures guys, the F-Stop Collaborate and Listen, and then Nick Page's podcast, and all these. There's so many. We'll put links if you guys, you know,
I've
if your podcast...
got a whole list of them on my website.
But. Oh, perfect. I only have to give one link then, even better. So yeah, so you can go hear her. I mean, she's got so much to say, and that's why we're hitting so many little things here. But if you want to hear more, you can go to her site and see all the different places she's been. But you talked about on one of those, this technique that you have where you work on the color temperature to make some areas of an image warmer and some parts of them cooler. Can you explain what you're going for there?
Yeah, that's straight out of my color theory article. So in basic color theory, the thing about my article I think was so appealing to people is that it was color theory minus the theory. I just sort of dumped all the high level theoretical stuff and repackaged it as stuff that just makes sense and is useful. So yeah. That sort of thing where the theory behind that is that warm colors advance and cool colors recede. And there was a lot of science behind why that is, but I spare people all of that and just go with that idea. So if you want certain areas of your image that have a tonal value that might be close to something that you want to emphasize, and you want to push those back in the sort of hierarchy of the image, you want them not to compete, you want them not to sort of scream as loudly as they are, without kind of making it look some like awkward, like, you know, unnatural or something. Sometimes just tinting it, glazing it with a cooler color can do that. That can just sort of push it into the shadow realm a little bit. In addition to maybe a little bit of darkening, but you can sometimes only go so far with that. So oftentimes it's a color fix that really just does the trick.
So maybe an example would be a dune in Death Valley, or am I, I'm just making this, I'm just hoping I'm hitting on something here, where you've got the part that's lit and the part that's in shadow. And so instead of just making the part in shadow darker, I would go in and actually tint it somewhat, or am I totally off here?
I think the example in my color theory article that I used was a pinnacle, a spire of rock in the Dolomites, and it happened to have a scree field right behind it. So it's a bright red pinnacle of lit by the sun, and then it's got this bright white scree field behind it. And so it's two kind of competing things. So instead of allowing that scree field to just be really kind of bright and not allowing that pinnacle to really jump out, I tinted it a little bit cooler, and that helped it just kind of sit back and take a back seat.
That's so cool. And it goes right along with what you're talking about with these concepts and the hierarchy and everything. Like, you not only have to figure out, like, why would you want one thing to stand out and one thing to recede, or I mean, like, how to do it, but you need to know why. And that's because you want it to fit the hierarchy and the way that you want people to perceive the image.
Yeah, I actually have a whole article on that too, the two essential strategies to post-processing. And in that, I said that the one thing that the first one is aiding the composition. You know, what can you do to aid the composition? That's your first strategy, number one. And then besides that, it's what can you do to kind of add character to the image and play with the mood a little bit. And that's where you get to put on your artist beret and do fun stuff.
My favorite time. Yeah. My beret's in the closet right now, but yes. So, you know, probably the most, I'm going to guess one of the most common questions you get and common questions that people are thinking right now that are listening to this is, where can we go to get an entire course, an entire tutorial on the things that you're talking about and seeing you go through in video or whatever it may be? Where can we go get that? And I think the answer is you can't yet, but tell us all about it.
If it weren't for my home and office burning down in November, that would be out right now. So that was a big project, big hope from of mine that in November of last year, I was going to put that out because that is one of the most common questions I get. When are we getting a processing tutorial? It will come as soon as I can. I'm really backed up after that disaster kind of messed things up in my world.
So we'll just mention this quickly, but yes, I mean, you had just gotten, you just moved into the house a week before the campfire, right? This last summer, and it took down the entire city, right? I mean, pretty much.
Wiped out all of paradise, yeah.
Exactly, yeah, crazy.
Not an inhabitable town anymore.
yeah, and following you on Facebook, I guess, and seeing the videos you were posting was one of the scariest things I've ever seen of you driving through the, you know, there's fire on both sides of the road and you guys just made it through. And then I remember seeing a post where you said, we've made it to a hotel, we're safe, we're having a drink. And the next post just a couple hours later was, no, they're evacuating the hotel. Yeah. And I mean, I don't want to bring, I'm sorry, nuts. I don't want to bring on like a PTSD in here. But this was a really, really scary situation.
That was terrifying, actually. The scariest part was really trying to get out of there, driving through fire and all that. It was a 3-hour ordeal. Because when I was actually evacuating the house, I was like, you got to be kidding me. I just put all this stuff away. I have unpacked my last box. This house is not going anywhere. It's going to be fine. I was totally calm. I'm just like, oh, this is just a huge waste of time.
You know? It wasn't,
And it wasn't until I got in the car and started driving that it was like, oh, wow, I could die. I'm about to die. And then it was quite terrifying, yes.
So you said you just did a whole podcast on this whole thing. So I don't want to bring the whole thing up. Where can we go to listen to that? Because it was also about like how to react and how to overcome these types of disasters.
Yeah, that's Ugo Che's The Traveling Image Makers podcast. And we talked all about the fire. The whole story is there. And we also talked about really important things about like rebounding from a disaster and also backup strategies. Make sure that all your files are there no matter what. Yeah,
because you could have your things backed up 5 times, but if they're all at your house and your house, great. All right, so we'll put a link to that as well, or maybe you have it at the same place on your site, or you will.
I will, yeah, it's coming out soon.
Okay, right, because you just did that one. So, yeah, okay, that's some crazy stuff, and people can go hear about all of that. Now, we said for social media, is it killing creativity? My other question is it like killing locations? Is it killing the natural areas as well sometimes too? You know, you hear about this in maybe Iceland or whatever, where it's like, wow, I want to get that same shot. I want to be where Justin Bieber was. And now they've ruined all the moss and everything from everyone trampling it.
Yeah.
What is our responsibility as educators to educate people in terms of preserving the natural environment?
I think our responsibility is very high. And I think what we need is a multi-pronged approach. You know, it's not as simple as just banning people from going places. We need to educate them. In fact, I think that's exactly the most productive route. So I personally have been putting out little videos on Instagram, not telling people don't go somewhere, but here's how to walk in this place when you go here. I had two different videos I put out on that. And I've also integrated in all of my workshops, I think for the last 2 years, a Leave No Trace section that I make right up front during the orientation. They all have to listen to that. And then I do a little, before we go to any kind of new biome or environment on a workshop, we do a little sort of group hug and I huddle and I explain to them the issues that might come up with walking around in that area and I ask them to be mindful of certain things. So those are some things that we can do. But I think it's also important to be mindful of the Leave No Trace organization's recommendation that we not specify locations. So I have a couple of friends who are labeling every single photo they take, no matter where it is in the world, Mesa Arch, which I think is wonderful. I'm just very, very vague, and I have been all along for at least the last 5 years. I will say Dolomites, Death Valley, and leave it at that. You know, I'm not going to send millions of people to a specific location by calling it out online. It's a whole different thing to bring, you know, a group of 10 or 12 people who've just been through your whole Leave No Trace business, you know, one little group at a time.
Yeah, and you're with them. Yeah.
Yeah, you're with them, and they understand the importance of the place. You've just impressed upon them your love for it, and you've also given them guidance for how to take care of it. That's a whole different thing than just labeling in your image or geotagging, go here, guys, to millions. You know, that's a whole different thing.
Right. And I don't want to, you know, pigeonhole any of this or what, and maybe I'm not right, but I feel that most of the people that we work with really care about these areas and that they, yeah, like I said, I don't want to stereotype whatever, but I feel that there's a lot of people that are on Instagram that are possibly younger that are just like, oh, I just want to get that shot. And they're not interested in anything else. And I don't know. I think it's those people that we just got to be kind of careful with. I don't know.
Yeah, that circles back to the first part of your question. And I think I'd like to address that and kind of, I think these two things go together, which is like the killing creativity thing. So I do feel that one of the things that social media, and I've written about this too, it can be problematic, a problem with it, is that it encourages it because of this decay cycle of images that go online, especially on Instagram. I think an image, the algorithm will kill it off after about 24 hours, right? So it has about a day's run. And so people feel like they're just sort of like a little hamster on a wheel and they've got to keep pumping out new shots. And it's the same thing with, you know, the younger generation. That's what they see, is it's just, what can you do as quickly as possible and without having to put a whole lot of sort of exploration time in and all the rest of it, how can I pump out as many photos as possible as quickly as possible? And the easy thing is just go do what you've seen everybody else do. And that just cuts you right to the chase. You go there and you shoot that. So I think these two things are really related. If we can kind of pull people back, they do, you know, to give them some space to be creative, not make them feel like they have to produce a new shot every single day or whatever. You know, I recently had a friend who I saw post pretty much everything he shot from a whole week of shooting, you know, like every dune he saw, you know, ended up on the internet. And I feel that that's, where are you going to give yourself time to think? And it's also, that's the message that just keeps getting perpetuated on social media. If you see people just pumping stuff out, you say, oh, I got to do that too. And I got to find a way to make it work. and going out and exploring and finding new stuff and being creative, it works exactly in the opposite direction as pumping stuff out as quickly as you can.
All right. Fabulous. I love this. Right from the very first question, we were very in-depth on all of this and really going into it. Can we do a speed round?
Sure.
These are from your people. Have you ever played Dungeons and Dragons? That's what someone wanted to know.
Used to love it. I was a dungeon master every time.
Really? Yeah. Wow. I really thought your answer was going to be no, and then we were going to have to figure out some way to do this. Yeah, well, here, that is supposed to be a speed round, but go into it just a little bit. And do you think it affects your photography?
Yeah, it's like it's being creative, right? I loved making the mazes and I loved all the beautiful dice. It was fun.
I agree. And then do you, like your images are epic and they kind of are like, you know, some of the images you might see in some of the Dungeons and Dragons things, not that I would ever know. do you think that there's something there too?
Oh, well, I'm a dreamer, you know, so yeah, you know, I'm adventurous and I'm an adventurer and a dreamer and Dungeons and Dragons has a similar ethos. Yeah.
I like that. I was playing with my 6-year-old boy last night. So, yes. Cool. You know, I don't really know the actual rules, but we rolled dice and we had fun. It was good. You're always wearing your purple jacket and other purple stuff. Why purple? Yeah. That's what your people want to know.
Yeah.
Genuinely there's actually interested.
A podcast episode. Well, big question on that too. But basically, it started out of mountaineering because it was one of the 1980s kind of official mountaineering colors. Because you can be easily spotted in red, yellow, bright blue, and purple. And so I just thought, well, when I want to be a little more feminine when I'm out in the mountains. And so I adopted purple. And then it kind of became my lucky shooting color. And then it kind of became like a branding thing. And then it kind of became like mandatory. And people would just yell at me if I'm not wearing purple. I post something online, I'm not wearing purple. I hear about it.
Yeah, like I said, you got to make the people happy. That's great. And then last thing, like who are some other landscape photographers that you really respect that if someone's, wanting to get more into this, they want to be like you, but there's probably, you know, to get different perspectives on it. Who else do you recommend that they follow? Maybe even like some up and coming people. I don't know. Give us something.
Yeah. Well, my go-to sources of inspiration are absolutely my Photo Cascadia teammates. So first and foremost, those guys are awesome, not only because they're great photographers, but they're great people. And I love their positive attitude. And I think that if you just look to what those guys are doing, they're infectiously positive people. You're never going to see these guys getting online and criticizing or bashing other photographers. They're just super inclusive and encouraging of all styles of photography, and I definitely look up to them for that. Also a lot of my, you know, my workshop co-leaders, you know, in particular, I'd just like to give a shout out to Alexandre Deschamps. I teach a lot of workshops with him, but he's very, I think, different from what a lot of people are seeing on Instagram. He's a very sort of avant-garde artist, and he makes things work. He's a good example of how you can have a really wonderful career as a landscape photographer and not be the hamster on the wheel.
Right.
So yeah, people like that. I mentioned Michaela Griffith, I think, on last time we talked, and I really enjoy her work. It's very it's small scenes and soft and creative. She frequently surprises me. I see things that, you know, I don't feel like I've seen that before. And as far as the up and comers, you know, I have been just got off a run of 6 workshops in a row. It took me 2 months to complete. And I'm feeling a little out of the loop actually on what other people are doing. And I would love to hear from other people who they think, who's up and coming, because I'd like to know that myself. I need to start digging in and exploring some of the photographers who are just getting started a little bit more.
Yeah. Well, and there's a lot of them out there and some people doing really good work. Yeah. But it is just super impressive to hear all of your thoughts on this stuff. And you have such a great handle on it, from the technical to the creative in terms of the conceptual and the color theory and everything. And just if you're listening to this podcast and you haven't seen Aaron's work, you need to go to her website, aaronbobnick.com, and just check it out. You'll be amazed. You'll spend a long time there going through all the things, and they're just epic images, and I love them, and I'm just so happy that we've been so lucky to have you at all of our events.
You are very kind, Chris. Thanks so much.
That's good. You're awesome. So thank you so much. Thanks for doing the podcast. Was there anything else we should be saying? Did we forget anything? I feel like we covered everything, right? We did a lot of stuff there.
We did a lot. That was pretty good. I think people are going to be happy with hearing the answers to their questions.
Well, we said we want to make the people happy. That's what we're here for. So I hope that we did that. All right. Well, thank you very much to Aaron Bobnick, and we'll see you next time on the Out of Chicago podcast. All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Chris. Bye.